Welcome to Banfield. By now, we've all become pretty familiar with the drill. Breaking news banners streak across your TV set. Kids come flooding out of a school, hands raised high in the air, and then the death toll starts ticking. It's a repeated story unique to America. And yesterday, Michigan's Oxford High School was added to the list. Four students dead, seven other badly hurt, seven other people. Lives changed forever. One of them a teacher. All of this took less than 5 minutes for the shooter to fire off 30 rounds, but he still had 18 left. In a moment, I'm going to show you the life-saving things that many of those students did yesterday, something called ALICE training that may have ensured those 18 bullets did not find another live target. It is training that could serve every single one of us, adults included, very well in our own lives. More for a moment now about that alleged shooter, 15 years old, fellow student, but they are charging him as an adult, and the case against him is bad. They want him moved right away from the Children's Center to a full-on grown-up jail. Prosecutors say it was premeditated murder, that he had a methodical plan. And they say there's a mountain of digital evidence against him, including videos, social media, and a diary. What's even more heartbreaking, his parents were just at the school that morning. They were meeting because the school called his behavior concerning. Was it a red flag? It's hard to say. But in the U.S., 19 states have something called red flag laws to try to avoid tragedies like this. Michigan, not one of those states. Florida is. You'll remember that's where 17 people died during the Parkland shooting in 2018 at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. And that's where we find News Nation's Brian Enten tonight. Brian, the kids who were there for that shooting, they have all graduated, but it really feels for most of us like it was yesterday. Tell me a little bit about how, you know, what happened in Michigan has got to be felt very strongly where you are. And then these red flag laws, where that may have actually played in.
Yeah, absolutely, Ashley. You know, Oxford, Michigan, it's a small town. For the last 24 hours, I've heard so many people there say, I cannot believe this happened here. Well, that is exactly how the people here in Parkland felt almost 4 years ago when they dealt with their awful school shooting. And one of the things that came out of the school shooting here is the red flag law in Florida. You mentioned it. It's also in 19 other states right now. Basically, the way it works is if you know someone with guns that you believe is going to harm others or is going to harm themselves, you can call 911, notify the police. They investigate. They have to get a judge involved. And if a judge signs off that this person is going to harm others they believe or harm themselves, they can actually remove those guns for a temporary period of time, hoping to stop any kind of destruction.
Now, Brian, you talked to some Parkland parents today. One of them talked about the red flag law, saying that really would have helped.
Yeah, I talked with Max Schachter. His son Alex was killed in the Parkland tragedy. He's basically made it his entire life mission now to stop school shootings. He does believe the red flag law may have helped, especially because of what you mentioned at the top of your show, that there were warning signs. There's almost always warning signs. We learn about them, sadly, after the fact with this Michigan 15-year-old. Apparently, he may have been posting to social media. He posted a video about wanting to kill classmates. There was the parent teacher conference 2 days in a row about disturbing behavior. Listen to what Max Schachter here in Parkland had to tell me. Do you think a red flag law could have made a difference in Michigan?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think every state should have a red flag law. If we know that someone is thinking about hurting themselves or others, due to this law, we have the ability to go in there, get a court order, and remove that dangerous weapon from that situation.
And while Michigan does not have a red flag law, they do have some very fast-acting sheriff's deputies. Ashley, I stood here in Parkland when the shooting happened for a month. One of the biggest issues was that law enforcement did not react fast enough here. They staged outside. The school resource officer here actually hid behind a wall and stayed on his radio while the shooting was happening. The total opposite happened yesterday in Michigan from what we've learned from the sheriff so far. The deputies went right in. They had the shooter within 2 minutes, and they stopped him while he still had 7 bullets in his magazine. The sheriff believes that he may have killed 7 more kids if they hadn't gotten in there right away and stopped him.
And 11 more in cartridges, too. So 18 total. Brian, thank you for that. It's, you know, it isn't just what the police did. Turns out it's what the kids did as well. And Brian, I'm going to go into that now for the audience, because they should really know about this next thing we're going to talk about. The shooting yesterday could have been so much worse. Many of those students in the Michigan high school, though, did something incredible. They instantly put their active shooter training to work. And you've probably heard about these drills. But more specifically, I want you to know about something called ALICE training. You heard me right. It's like the name, ALICE training. It's an acronym. Stands for A for alert, as in be alert when you first become aware that there's some kind of a threat. Be alert. Know what's going on. Lockdown. That basically means barricade the entry points and contain the shooter best you can. I is for inform. Communicate the shooter's location best you can. Counter, this is interesting, create noise and distance and distraction. Throw things, be loud. And that reduces the ability of the shooter to actually shoot accurately. And then last is evacuate. Get yourself out of that danger if it is safe to do so. This is what's being taught in schools across the country, folks. Remember when we were kids and it was just fire drills? No, this is what's happening. An Oxford High School just had an ALICE lockdown drill on October 7th. Fresh in their minds. If you want to see it in action, all you have to do is look just to the video from yesterday's attack. What I'm about to show you was shot by a student barricaded with others in one of the classrooms. And what I want you to watch for is how the kids respond when someone starts knocking on the locked classroom door, claiming to be police. Take a look.
Now, we're not willing to take that risk right now.
I can't hear you.
We're not taking that risk right now.
Okay, well, come to the door and look at my bag, bro.
No.
Yeah, bro.
He said bro.
He said bro. He said bro. Red flag.
Go.
Slow down, you're fine.
I want you to drop backpacks. We're okay. We're okay. Drop your backpacks.
Still. Christy?
Yes. Thank you. Drop your backpacks!
How about that? Did you hear that, kid? We're not comfortable yet. We're not opening the door for you. We don't know you are who you say you are. And then he heard someone on the outside of the door saying, bro. And they all said, red flag, a cop wouldn't say bro. Turned out it was actually a cop, more likely an undercover cop, which they told us today. Oakland County Sheriff also said that that training, that ALICE training, likely saved lives.
There is an extensive camera system, thanks to the proactive work of Oxford Schools. And I'll also say on the proactive side, we've worked with Oxford Schools. Our liaison taught them in ALICE. That saved lives. And after going through the scene last night and seeing it in a very non-rushed fashion, those practices were used and they saved lives. Desks were upturned, doors were barricaded. Doors were actually hit by gunfire, and so were barricades. But the doors were safe. So that behavior, that training, and those protocols saved lives.
I want to bring in Jim Maxwell now. He's a former FBI agent who teaches active shooter drills. I will bet, and I'm just going to go out on a limb here, Jim, that when you saw that video, you thought, look at that. It actually works. You see the training actually almost step by step with these kids.
Yeah, yes, the kids in the school showed a lot of poise and grace under very difficult circumstances. And as far as the lockdown is concerned, it varies from school district to school district. But when you go into lockdown mode, the administrative group or the teachers who receive this training are told not to open doors until they receive a signal, the all-clear signal, which is predetermined. These students were on their own, And they evaluated this correctly and did the right thing. They did not open the door, and their actions saved a lot of lives that day.
It's interesting. The one young man in the front looks like he's wearing a hockey jersey, seemed to be the leader. Is that part of the drill, or did he just take that upon himself?
He probably. Some people, leadership just rises to the moment sometimes. And I have to tell you that when I teach this course, I go by the Department of Homeland Security guidelines, and which is run, hide, or fight. But it varies from venue to venue. When we teach it at a hospital, there are different priorities. When we teach it at a school, lockdown is the priority. And we teach kids and we teach staff that two things are most important. You know, you can learn all the rules and what your options are, but you have to remain calm. We've learned from our research and study of these things, these situations, is that the people who remain calm make good decisions. And this is a classic example. These kids did not get hysterical. They evaluated what was going on. They realized that this was a ruse, and they got out of there. They did an excellent job.
I could not believe these were kids. Having heard the gunshots and everything, and just to be able to have that conversation with the, again, it ended up being a policeman on the other side of the door, but they weren't taking chances, thank God. Something I learned today that, I mean, I'm happy, but I'm also so sad at the same time that schools are now being built specifically with architecture that takes into account the, you know, isolating and locking down and containing a shooter. That just, it hurts my heart to think that, but at the same time, I think parents who are watching or grandparents would probably feel calmed, you know, knowing that.
Well, Ashley, I couldn't agree with you more. It is sad, but, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and schools and hospitals and churches were places of refuge. And it's sad that this is a growing trend, and it's not going to go away. And unfortunately, we have to protect ourselves against these things. So the design of schools, putting solenoid locks in schools, and where you could lock down a classroom or a group of classrooms with a push of a button, those things are designed in here for that purpose, because speed is of the essence here. You have to react quickly to these matters, and you cannot stop and ask a question or ask permission. You have to act to protect the students and yourself. And that's where
you
training
know
comes
what to
in.
Do. Yeah. And right. that business about being alert right away, obviously that kid who stood up and led that classroom and the rest of them listening for the word bro, and it says red flag. That was really bright. I just wanted to extrapolate a little bit for everybody who's watching. Maybe they don't have kids and they think I'm afraid when I'm in a movie theater or in a mall. The run, and fight and hide, or how does it go? Run, hide, fight? No.
Run, hide, fight.
Walk me through what I would do if I'm not in a classroom. It's not a barricaded door. I'm in a situation where it's the egress might be questionable. So walk me through what I would need to do to employ this smartness of these kids, but in a different circumstance with grownups.
Well, I think in this day and age, when you go out to a movie theater, you go out to a restaurant, you go out to a concert, you have to have what we call situational awareness. You have to go into a place and look to see where the exits are. Do the doors open in? Do the doors open out? You have to think about these things these days, because if you have to make the decision to leave, you got to know how to get out of the area. I know people who are professionals like firemen, you know, they check into a hotel, and the first thing they look down a hallway, where are the exits in case there's a fire? It's just, you know, for a professional, that's a normal course of action. But in today's day and age, every citizen has to be aware and establish that situational awareness when they go out in public. These poor people that were mowed down in Wisconsin the other day, they had no idea that would happen, and they were completely blindsided by it. And it's unfortunate, but I think when we go out into public places, we have to have that mindset and be looking over our shoulder.
Situational awareness. Jim Maxwell, thank you for your wisdom tonight. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
I want to bring in Dr. John Duffy now. He's a clinical psychologist and a parenting and relationship expert. All right. So, Dr. Duffy, you just saw that one kid who stood up and took the lead. First of all, the bravery that it would take at that age. There's two things that I thought. wow, this training is incredible. Did it ever work? And then it broke my heart that a kid that age has to train and go through these things. And millions of kids all across the country are training for this sort of thing, almost becoming too grown up before they should. Should I be worried about these kinds of sort of emotional scars that these kids who aren't going through the shootings are actually taking on?
Yeah, you know, it's such a double-edged sword, right? Because the training clearly works. It is remarkable to watch the leadership in that video and how these kids kind of came together and saved each other's lives. But for other kids, there is this level of anxiety that gets reached, even with the drills, so much so that after drills, some of the kids I work with don't want to go to school the next day for fear of another school shooting. So you're right, there is this element of innocence lost that we don't want to entirely disregard here.
And you know, I often think what about the kids who have been in school with these school shooters. The school shooters are learning the same things. They're learning the same tricks. And so that's got to be really messing with the kids who are asking the questions, knowing full well whoever's behind the door could easily know what I know.
100%. That's so true, Ashley. And kids have brought that up to me that, you know, like when you see video like you saw yesterday, as amazing as it is to see it, more and more kids see more and more of these videos and tricks of the trade of school shootings become more and more apparent. And these kids get more and more clever about the ways that they infiltrate the system. So this creates even more anxiety and fear in the kids who are not the perpetrators, but the potential victims. And that's an ongoing concern for those of us in the mental health community, for sure.
It's so hard to be a kid these days. I mean, we think about just their everyday struggles with social media, and then we forget they're going through these trainings probably quarterly, so it's just always on their minds. One last question for you, and that is this. We talked about red flags off the top of the show. Every day a principal has a kid in the office. Every day that could be a red, you could think of it as a red flag. How are you supposed to sort out the naughty kids from the deadly kids?
This is the million-dollar question, right? If we could do this perfectly, we would be done with these school shootings by and large. What we want to watch out for by and large are kids that are impulsive, have had a dramatic shift in behavior very, very recently. This is where it takes a village, where you want to hear from teachers, social workers, principals, deans, and parents, right? Where everybody has to get together and note, oh, we've seen a dramatic change. This child is suddenly very taken with violence or guns, or they seem angry or even elated. Any kind of big dramatic change in behavior is worth looking into and sharing with some of the other adults involved so that we can kind of get a feel for these red flags all together and kind of put a piece together so that we understand where we're headed here and whether we need to take action with a particular child.
It's great information. Dr. Duffy, thank you. I hope you'll come back again.
Thank you, Ashley.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to switch gears. Coming up, what do Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Matthew McConaughey have in common? And I'm not talking about the movies. They have hinted at winning an election one day, like Clint Eastwood and Al Franken and Donald Trump and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Fred Thompson and Sonny Bono. Look at those famous faces. But is fame now almost a prerequisite to getting into office? How did Trump change the game? One TV doctor had better take note. He's writing his own election prescription as we speak. But what is the prognosis for one Dr. Oz? That's next. From the box office to the soapbox, there is a long list of celebrities in this country who have made the transition from Hollywood to Washington. The latest is Dr. Oz. Here to weigh in is David Frum, staff writer with The Atlantic. Dave, questioned, do you think that Dr. Oz can actually make it to the Emerald City riding on his talk show fame?
He's going to have a tough time. The reason Dr. Oz is in the race is that there was a designated favorite. someone endorsed by President Trump, a congressman or a candidate named Sean Parnell, who got caught up in a terrible domestic abuse story. He dropped out, and the field is now open. So Oz is in. So is a hedge fund CEO named David McIntosh. So are some others. And it's a very wide open race. But here's the thing about Dr. Oz. There's a lot about him that's goofy and kooky, and he recommends a lot of celery juice to treat things that celery juice doesn't treat. But he has been extremely forthright on the subject of vaccinations. He had himself videotaped for his Facebook page in January of 2021 being vaccinated. He's been clear that you should get a booster. He's been clear that kids 5 to 11 should get inoculated, vaccinated. And that has been more courage, more forthrightness than many people in the Republican Party have shown. So if he can just be a voice for, even if you believe in celery juice, get vaccinated, that would be a powerful thing.
But you think these images that we're showing make everybody forget about those early days with Dr. Drew, when they were saying all sorts of questionable things about hydroxychloroquine and the pandemic itself?
No, I don't think they'll make anyone forget. I think the problem we have is the Republican Party has become a party in which the questionable things are the dominant position. You have governors of states saying it's a personal question whether I've been vaccinated or not, refusing to answer, refusing to be photographed. So whatever is, I'm not suggesting that Dr. Oz has been a font of medical wisdom. By and large, you should not drink celery juice if you're seriously sick. But what he has done is he's taken a line, at least in the early days, on vaccination that is more forward-leaning, more close to the truth than so many others. That's going to be maybe a point of vulnerability for him, but it could also be a point of strength for America to say, even Dr. Oz, goofy as he can be, understands, get vaccinated.
Get vaccinated. Okay, so then I just want to talk to you a little bit about the celebrity factor, because we had this crazy video by Matthew McConaughey who took, like, I don't know, 1,000 minutes to say he wasn't going to run. And then we've got rumors about Dwayne The Rock Johnson and, you know, polls that say he could win instantly if he were to run. And I always think it's sort of the Trump factor, and then people always remind me about Reagan. But the difference is that Reagan had quite a political background before he ran for president. He was, you know, the head of a union twice, and he was the governor of California. But nowadays, it doesn't seem like you have to have that background. And I'm wondering if that's the Trump effect, if it's a blip, or if it weren't for Trump, would there be a McConaughey and a Dwayne The Rock Johnson even be talked about?
Well, look, there's something that is going on through all of our politics, and I think social media has a lot to do with it, which is that people are changing the job, and it's not just the politicians or the candidates who are the problem here, it's the voters, too, of what they expect a politician to do. There is decreasing patience with the person you send to Washington, send to the state capitol, and they bring back the bridge, they bring back the water filtration project, they bring back the road or the highway. People seem to want their representatives to act like self-actualizing influencers. And that's true both on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. So maybe the solution to the celebrity candidate is for voters to say, what do you really want a politician to do? Do you want them to strike attitudes, or do you want them to deliver?
Well, and then, you know, a lot of people say you need a front man. You can have, you know, as much of a team behind the front man as long as the front man's a good golden arches, you know, for the job. I want to put a few names up, because I look back at these people, and I'm sure loads of jokes were made about them as they were thinking of putting their hat in the ring and then running. But Fred Thompson, Al Franken, Sonny Bono, Clint Eastwood, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Donald Trump, and I'm going to make the list even longer. Fred Grandy, Bill Bradley, Steve Largent, Kevin Johnson, Jesse Ventura, Shirley Temple. Say what you will about some of them, but for the most part, lots of them were Republicans. There wasn't a lot of ugliness said about their work, and yet we still hear the Hollywood elite liberals and all the rest, but they tend to do okay.
Well, there are two things that make a celebrity candidate a good force in America. The first is if the candidate has modest goals about what the office they want. Clint Eastwood, famous movie star, wants to be mayor of the town in which he has a house. He's not trying to be a senator or a president. He's content to be mayor and to use his celebrity to get some things done for his town that he thought were important to get done. And he ran for mayor. I think he was elected 2 or 3 times, and then he quit, and he didn't try to make politics the rest of his life. The other thing that can make a celebrity candidate a positive force is if there's something more to them. Fred Thompson, yes, Fred Thompson was a giant TV star. Before that, he was a counsel to the Watergate Committee back in the 1970s. He knew his Washington. He left Washington to become an actor, and then he went back from being an actor to return to politics. Where you get into trouble is when you don't respect the difficulty of the job of politics. When you say, because I've been a giant star, I can therefore start at the top. And that is, I think, what happened with President Trump. Even President Trump's strongest admirers have to admit he didn't put a lot of work into the job. He didn't often know what was going on. He didn't know how to get things done. He'd never paid attention to how politics works. The presidency is a job, and it's a bad place to get on the job training.
I hope that Kanye West is listening to this right now. Who knows? But you're right. And I absolutely love talking to you, and you better come back. You hear me?
Thank you.
Welcome back. It is not a crime not to remember everything you said and everything you did and with whom you did it a quarter of a century ago. But if you are on a witness stand and your recollections could send someone to prison for life, it is really good to have as many of your facts straight as possible, such as the year you flew to New York City to see The Lion King on Broadway. And with that on your mind, I want to take you to the high drama today in the sex trafficking trial of Jeffrey Epstein's former girlfriend, or should I say Girl Friday, Ghislaine Maxwell. Her lawyers picked apart the details of past statements and earlier testimony from a woman known only as Jane on the stand. Jane told investigators that creepy Epstein took her to see The Lion King in 1994 when she was just 14, just a girl. But it was pointed out in cross-examination that The Lion King did not debut on Broadway until 1997. And that was when Jane was 17, which may or may not mean anything in itself. But Jane also was forced to admit today that she can't remember whether she and Maxwell and Epstein were all together in one room or alone together, or she just couldn't remember. She did say, still under cross-examination, though, that Epstein also flew her to Mar-a-Lago in 1994, where she met that guy, Donald Trump. She did not accuse Donald Trump of any wrongdoing. And with that, I want to bring in my guest, British journalist and author Nigel Cawthorne. He has written more than 200 titles, the latest of which is Ghislaine Maxwell, The Fall of America's Most Notorious Socialite. Okay, Nigel Cawthorne, you are the perfect guest because that's a lot to take in all at the same time. I thought that Ghislaine Maxwell did not want to draw a lot of attention to all the famous high-level people that she and Jeffrey Epstein associated with, and yet it's her lawyers who are bringing up testimony that include Prince Andrew and Donald Trump and President Clinton and Kevin Spacey. So what am I to make of that? Has she changed her strategy?
Well, it does seem rather odd. It's nice that Jane made no allegations about Donald Trump, but she said that Epstein had bought her a dress, a costume, to appear at the Miss Teen America contest, and there've been also allegations about Donald Trump turning up in the girls' changing rooms while they were naked or half naked. So Donald's got off there lightly, I think.
Okay. Leading up to this for the last couple of years, there was so much made about Ghislaine Maxwell's little black book. And I don't know if she had a little black book, but she sure had a black book in her head. All of the people with whom she connected her, you know, I call him the paramour, the boss, the guy who paid the bills, the guy who gave her money. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein was her everything. And I still can't figure out why. So I'm going to give you a two-part question. Why on earth did she stay with Jeffrey Epstein, even though he was no longer interested in her? And then what does she know that could get a lot of people in trouble that might come out in this trial?
Well, it is rather intriguing, her whole psychology. Well, I must remember the very difficult relationship she had with her father, and she seems to be playing a bit of the same role here, that when she was born, it coincided with the death of her. She was the youngest of the family. Her oldest brother died around the same time that Robert Maxwell always thought would take over his media empire, but Michael, the oldest,
she was
brother,
the darling. He loved her. He gave everything to her. I think he named, you know, things after her, boats after her, and all the rest. But in the meantime, why would that have connected her to a guy like Jeffrey, who was like a pedophile?
Well, he did. But the first few years of her life, both her parents completely ignored her, to the point where when she was about five, she went to her mother and said, "Mummy, I exist." And then when she grew up, admittedly, she became the apple of Robert Maxwell's eye. But he both pampered her and bullied her. She performed much of the role that she did later for Epstein, when he wanted to take over the New York Daily News, for example. He sent her over to New York to make contacts, to introduce him to society there, and began her little black book, if you will. After Robert Maxwell died, she then moved to New York and almost immediately connected with Epstein. There is talk that actually that Robert Maxwell's millions, which were actually stolen from the pension funds of his media empire in London, were funneled through Donald Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein. So there is a strange financial relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, I'd say strange to the tune of about $30 million. That's reportedly what she had amassed in terms of a fortune. And she sure didn't make it by just being a socialite, that's for sure. She kind of got to New York.
It's very much the defense claims that the accusers in this case are just out there to make money, whereas one wonders where her money came from.
Oh, exactly. That's a very good point, which I think will be brought up in court. Nigel Cawthorn, thank you so much. It's great to see you. And I know it's early, early in the morning, too, over there across the pond. So thank you for doing this. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And we're back right after this. Don't go away. This just in, this is my writing. But it's interesting. If you're a Dr. Oz fan and you're in Philadelphia, New York, or Cleveland, you're not going to be able to see his show anymore because the stations have pulled it because he's announced that he's a candidate now for U.S. Senate. And, you know, then all of the equal time rules get in there. So they just pulled it. And I would expect that's probably going to happen in a few more places. But that's one bit of news. And then the other thing is back to that Maxwell thing. Keep your ears peeled on this one because there's no cameras in the courtroom. There was this amazing story about her having multiple passports like France and England and Israel and even a Saudi Arabian passport. So that might come into this trial. And it might hook a bunch of famous names in too, like Clinton and Trump and Prince Andrew and Kevin Spacey and Bill Richardson and Alan Dershowitz. And I'm still waiting to find out what she's got to say about all those men who had some connection to Epstein. But you'll have to stay tuned to Banfield to find out. We'll see you back here tomorrow, 10 p.m. Eastern.